It's 10:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. The financial collapse of 2008 didn't just hit the United States. It struck countries and regions all over the world. Different countries have dealt with the crisis and are dealing with it in various ways, mostly with some rather harsh austerity measures designed to bring sovereign debt under control. Iceland, however, took a truly unique approach, and their economy is now growing at a modest rate and they've begun repaying their IMF loans ahead of schedule. Well, this hour we're going to talk about what they did, but more than that, we're going to focus on the Eurozone this morning. There's talk of Greece leaving. What would that mean? What of the election of a socialist to lead France? What does that mean for the European Union? Has austerity worked, or as some have said, has it made things worse? And what about Iceland? Could their path out of the financial crevasse show the way for other countries? All of those questions we'll try to get to this hour, and we'll take yours as well. My guest this morning is Jacob Funk Kierkegaard, research fellow at the Peterson Institute and a senior associate at the Rhodium Group, a New York-based research firm. Good morning, Mr. Kierkegaard, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
Good morning.
Let's start with Europe. Greece is grabbing the headlines. There are still problems in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Ireland. Trouble pretty much everywhere you look in the Eurozone.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt that what the crisis has done is that it has, I think more than anything, sort of laid bare the fundamentally faulty design of the euro area or the common currency as a whole, basically showing that it's a currency that lacks the fundamental institutions to survive in the long term. And since that's a very fundamental political problem that Europe faces, which goes much beyond the fact that Greece has a fiscal problem, Ireland has a banking problem, Spain has a banking and housing problem. This is really fundamentally about the design of Europe. And that's why, one, it is taking such a long time to solve, because you are fundamentally dealing with what it comes down to is national sovereignty. What Europe needs to do, it needs to pool a lot of national sovereignties, or much more of it, at the European level, so that it not only has a monetary union, but also has a fiscal, banking, and economic union. And, you know, governments don't like to hand over sovereignty. That's why it is, in my opinion, taking so long. But also at the same time, why, you know, it's sad to say, but the crisis is probably an indispensable component in this process. Without the acute crisis, the tough political decisions that are necessary in Europe wouldn't be taken.
Well, I'm imagining that one of those is, right now the European Central Bank it can create money, but it doesn't have anything to, there's nothing behind it. I don't even understand how that can possibly work.
Well, we have to keep in mind, I don't think it's true to say that there's nothing behind it, because we have to remember that the European Central Bank is a sort of a uniquely structured central bank, because it is really a two-layer central bank. We have the ECB in Frankfurt, and then we have all the national central banks of the euro area in the sort of second layer. But if we're talking about what stands behind the ECB, it's actually not just the capital of the ECB itself, but it's the capital of all the member state central banks. And that actually is quite a lot of capital. I mean, they would easily have, you know, they're not nearly as undercapitalized as many people suggest they are. But I think more to the point about the political challenge that Europe faces, the ECB is in a position that it is the only institution that actually operates and works for the entire euro area. There is no European finance ministry. There is no treasury, which means that the ECB is essentially being forced to take very political decisions throughout this crisis, decisions that we here in the United States, the Federal Reserve, would never take. it would always be left to Congress and the Treasury. But because Europe doesn't have those these institutions, or and certainly didn't have them at the beginning of the crisis, it has essentially been incumbent upon the ECB to orchestrate, you know, through hooks and crooks, country bailouts. Either they have done it by extending, shall we say, their central bank mandate quite significantly by purchasing government bonds in crisis-stricken countries, which is something that actually is technically illegal under the European treaty, or they have taken on an enormous amount of credit risk by providing unlimited liquidity to European banks so that these European banks can then turn around and support governments in Greece, Portugal, and elsewhere in the European periphery. But again, the fundamental problem here for the European Central Bank is that it doesn't have a partner. It doesn't have a treasury. It would be a little bit like back in 2008 here in the United States, that Ben Bernanke, you know, was the only man on the bridge, that there was no Hank Paulson, there was no TARP, there was no support from the U.S. Treasury. In that situation, I think everybody would probably agree that the financial crisis here in the United States would have taken a very different track. But unfortunately, because of these fundamental institutional weaknesses of the euro area, that's the situation the ECB has found itself in.
Well, let's talk about that just from a little bit different perspective. There's an article in the Guardian titled "Bailing Out Germany: The Story Behind the European Financial Crisis," which suggests that quite a bit of the problems that some countries like Spain and others have had were not. It wasn't necessarily because of bloated social welfare systems and unwise borrowings by greedy governments, but it was these states having to bail out their own private banks who had been doing too much speculating without enough capital, and that the private banks are responsible for quite a bit of the problems that some of these countries are having.
Oh yeah, no, there's no doubt that the idea that is often heard from various pundits and policymakers in Europe that this crisis is only a fiscal crisis, that it really is about government overspending, etc. That is a complete myth. That it may be largely true in Greece, but it is certainly not true in countries such as Ireland or Spain. Whereas you correctly point out, the real reason for the crisis that these countries are in right now is that these countries had enormous housing bubbles. I mean, far beyond anything, maybe with the exception of you know, some particular parts of the United States like Nevada and elsewhere, but far beyond anything we had at a national scale here in the United States. And what these countries are now facing is the sort of dual cost of both the very significant employment losses when the real estate construction sector collapses. Then, of course, the hit to private consumption that follows when housing prices in these countries, in the case of Ireland, housing prices have dropped nationally about 50%. You know, which is almost twice what we have seen here in the United States. And then finally, the cost of actually bailing out these banks, which in the case of Ireland was enough to force the country into the arms of the IMF. Because ultimately, when the Irish government decided to try to bail out its banks, nobody believed that was credible because of the scale of the bad debts in the Irish banking system. And therefore, the government itself had to seek a bailout. So it's very much a situation where reckless lending and speculation in the run-up to the crisis, up to late 2007, 2008, that is at the core of this crisis in certainly Spain and Ireland in Europe, absolutely.
Well, the reason I brought that up is that the IMF and the European Central Bank and others are demanding tons of austerity measures and charging higher interest rates. Some say that's counterproductive and that this will only cause more problems. And because supposedly, you know, as I brought up from the Guardian article, there are a lot of people who just say, well, this is a problem of government overspending. So my question is, has austerity worked and can it work? Some have said that these severe cuts in government spending have actually made the economic downturn worse rather than improving the situation, and that long term, this is a losing game.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the austerity has made the crisis quite a lot worse in the short run because these cuts have been very significant. And therefore, the idea that you can cut spending by, you know, 2, 3, and 4% of GDP and not have a significant negative impact on economic growth, I mean, that's, again, a myth. So there's no doubt that in the short run, austerity has made the economic crisis worse in Europe. But I will say, though, that I think it's important to keep in mind that quite a lot of this austerity, in at least in some of the countries in question, regretfully, in my opinion, has been necessary. And that therefore, to say that it has made the economic crisis worse is one thing, but to say that you instead should have done a fiscal stimulus in these countries is quite a different thing, because I don't think that a fiscal stimulus in either Spain, Ireland, or Greece, for that matter, or Portugal, or any of these peripheral countries, is really a credible policy option, given both the broader debt dynamics that these countries faces, but more importantly, the fact that all of these countries have very, very significant so-called structural deficits in their government, in their government sectors, and what it, and the reason for that is that when the housing bubbles and when the bubbles burst in these countries, a lot of very pro-cyclical revenue that these governments had simply disappeared. In the case of Ireland, in particular, this was this is a very significant issue for them, and they basically have to therefore go out and find new sources of revenue, because they cannot simply expect that the, you know, the housing housing market and construction sector is going to rebound anytime soon, and that's part of the reason for why these countries have gone out and, you know, they have implemented new taxes. They have obviously been forced to reduce spending quite significantly, but acknowledging that it has made the crisis worse in the short run, I have to say that I think in the euro area peripheral countries, it is not clear to me what the credible alternative to this policy has been.
We're going to take a break in just a moment. I want to throw out some questions maybe for our listeners, things you may want to bring up here in this discussion. First, though, I'll give the phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and leave a comment there as well. So, what do you think of all of this? Does it, how do you, when you read and you see and you hear stories about the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis, about what's going on with Greece, about whether they stay in the euro or not, and what that might mean? When you hear about what happened in Iceland, where they actually have prosecuted some of the banking officials who were at the heart of this collapse there in Iceland, and what they've done, when you hear about that, what does that make you think? When we look at the politics of our own country, and with a presidential election in full swing, and you have a lot of discussion about what austerity measures that the United States might take. How do you, when you see what's happened in Europe, how does that make you feel? What would you like to know about it? We've got an expert here who can answer your questions on how this stuff all works. and I invite you to participate. 800-486-8655. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I knew I'd do that once this morning. 800-642-1234. My bad. It's been one of those kind of days. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org and look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:22. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. Chris Ferris earned 7 Bronze Stars while serving with the Army's elite Delta Force. His wife told USA Today that combat, emotional distance, and all that time away nearly destroyed their marriage. After one today on Talk of the Nation, Lessons from a Military Marriage. Chris and Lisa Ferris join host Neil Conan. That's after 1 o'clock this afternoon on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the genesis of this program was what Iceland has done to try to emerge from the 2008 financial collapse. But it seemed to make more sense to start with a broader discussion of what's going on in Europe as a whole and how they're managing this. We will talk about Iceland before the end of the hour, but that's not the whole story. That's one small piece of it. And while it makes interesting copy, there's some question as to how much of it is applicable elsewhere. So I want to move our discussion along on the European situation with my guest, Jacob Kierkegaard, research fellow at the Peterson Institute and senior associate at the Rhodium Group, a New York-based research firm. All right. Now, there's been a lot of speculation in the news, even this morning, that Greece is going to leave the euro. Some are saying that the departure of Greece would destroy the European Central Bank because of its exposure to Greek debt. Do you agree with that assessment?
No. And I actually also do not believe that it is likely that Greece will ultimately leave the euro area, because what is going on right now in Greece is that you have an election between parties who basically support the current policies, the IMF program, and then some more populist parties that are very opposed to the IMF program, as well as the associated austerity and economic reforms. But it's very important to understand that these populist parties, Syriza is the most well-known of them, are actually all in favor of Greece staying in the euro, which means that even if they win the election, I regard it as highly unlikely that Greece will ultimately leave the euro. I think that there is another scenario that is likely to materialize, which is that if the populist parties in Greece win the election, they're going to tear up the agreement with the IMF and the other European countries. That means that they will probably, or they will, run out of money in a couple of months, which gives them, even if they stop all interest payments, etc., which gives them a number of options. Either they can implement immediate additional austerity to balance their books, or they can go out and, you know, seize private assets. They can try to seize bank deposits in Greece, or they can issue IOUs in the same way as California did back in 2009. But none of these things actually mean that Greece leaves the euro area. It didn't, you know, California wasn't leaving the dollar area or the United States just because it began issuing IOUs in 2009. But what will happen to Greece is that as a result of this, it is, as I said, quite likely to have an additional further economic contraction. It is quite likely to lose access to liquidity from the European Central Bank, which means that either the Greek banking system collapses, or it will have to or you will have to limit very significantly the amount of money you can withdraw from Greek banks, which ultimately means that Greece doesn't leave the euro area, but it becomes a little bit like Montenegro. And Montenegro is a country that has unilaterally euroized. It uses the euro. The euro is the unit of account, but it has no access to European central bank support or money from the European Union or the IMF, of course. But it nonetheless uses the euro. The key thing, of course, is to understand that Montenegro has a GDP per capita one-third of what Greece has. So this is not a scenario that is in any sense or shape pleasant for the Greek population. In fact, I will safely predict that it'll be much worse than even the current very severe recession that they're facing. But the bottom line is that a populist government in Greece is not going to take Greece out of the euro for the simple reason that taking Greece out of the euro remains overwhelmingly unpopular with the Greek population. And the iron law of populism is that if you're a populist, you don't do things that are really unpopular. So I think we should be a little careful with getting carried away with all these things, because as I said, I think this is a very unlikely scenario. And if it happened, there are ways the European Central Bank can protect itself. But I think I've gone on for too long already. Sorry.
Well, we have plenty of time at this point in the program. Later on, perhaps, so I'll need a shorter answer. But keep in mind that I barely scraped by with a B in my college economics class. So you'll have to maybe use small words from here on out. Let's talk a little bit about going forward. And in fact, let's hang on. We've got a comment from Frank in Madison. He called but couldn't hang on. He wanted to know, can the European Central Bank act as the Federal Reserve does, and why does it continue to follow Germany's views?
In principle, the European Central Bank can do whatever it wants. And this is sort of one of the ironies here. Is that the European Central Bank is actually far more independent than the Federal Reserve is. And you know, one of the things that I like to just to talk about that illustrates that is that back in the summer of last year, when the European Central Bank began to buy government debt in Spain and Italy, the European Central Bank sent a secret letter. It was subsequently leaked. So that's why we know about it. But they sent a secret letter to Silvio Berlusconi, who was then Prime Minister of Italy, basically telling him, look, we would like to support your government in the financial markets, but here is a list of economic reforms that you need to implement in order to, quote-unquote, earn our support. So basically, you had a situation where an independent central bank were making very significant reform requirement demands of an elected government. Essentially, a central bank telling politicians, look, this is what we want you to do, otherwise we're not going to help you. Now, Silvio Berlusconi at the time said, okay, yeah, I promise to do all these things. Then the ECB began to buy Italian government debt. But then Silvio Berlusconi did not honor his promises, after which the European Central Bank stopped buying Italian debt again. Subsequently, Italian interest rates began to rise dramatically, and ultimately the political situation in Italy became so unstable that Silvio Berlusconi lost his majority and had to resign. Now, just to, as a comparison, this would be the equivalent of if last year, if say the Federal Reserve had sent a letter to the Super Committee, the Congressional Super Committee, basically telling them, look, unless you come up with a credible long-term budget strategy for the United States, we are going to end all our monetary policy support. We're going to drive up long-term interest rates. The economy is going to tank, and you politicians in Congress are all going to be out of a job. Now, I think everybody would agree that if the Federal Reserve tried to do that, it wouldn't be an independent Federal Reserve for very long, because Congress would appropriately, I would say, change the Federal Reserve Act, very, very rapidly. But the fact that the ECB is able to do these, to make these kinds of political demands of the European politicians, reflect what I was talking about earlier, namely that it doesn't have a partner, it doesn't have a treasury, it is not accountable to a single government. It's accountable to 17 different governments, and therefore it is essentially, in my opinion, not accountable to anybody. The reason, and this is the irony here, is that despite the ECB actually having the power and the independence to do everything the Federal Reserve has done, and more, much more than that, in fact, the reason that they're not doing it is an issue of moral hazard. They basically do not want to bail out the European politicians from the decisions that they have to make about integrating the European economy much more and building the types of institutions that the euro area is lacking, which is why the European Central Bank never pre-commits. It never does what the Federal Reserve does, you know, when it announces long-term in advance, we're going to buy this many government bonds, this many mortgage bonds, we're going to keep short-term interest rates at close to zero, well into 2014. The ECB never does that, because if it were to do that, it would essentially let the European politicians off the hook. And that is not something that they're willing to do. So when the caller says that the ECB is doing Germany's calling, I actually don't think that that's entirely correct either. What the ECB is doing is that it is not a central bank like the Federal Reserve that does everything it can to end the crisis as soon as possible. What it does instead is that it basically, in many ways, tries to prolong the crisis, because it is only by the acute pressure of financial markets that European politicians are going to be willing to make these very tough political compromises that will be required in order to build a more lasting euro area and the with the required institutions, pan-European institutions.
We had an email from someone who wanted to ask, if the Eurozone is doing so badly, why is it that the euro's value as a currency is still so high? It's about 35% stronger against the dollar than when it first launched.
Well, I think that this is one of the reasons. I mean, I, as you can probably sort of gauge from a lot of my commentary, I actually don't think the euro is doing nearly as badly as a lot of the headlines that we hear suggest. And I think the fact that the euro's exchange rate is still so relatively strong, not just vis-a-vis the dollar, but vis-a-vis lots of other currencies as well, actually suggests that that despite all the headlines, is ultimately not a currency that is likely to collapse in a few months' time. But having said that, I would also say that the euro area has a great many problems. But it's also, I think, important to keep in mind that a bilateral exchange rate, in this case the euro-dollar exchange rate, is obviously determined by what goes on in both countries, both the euro area and the United States. And therefore, the sort of relative surprising strength of the euro, despite everything that goes on, I think to a certain extent also reflects the fact that, you know, the United States, we're a country that have our own problems. And therefore, you know, that is something that provides, shall we say, some support also for the euro area, namely that it is as much euro strength as it is dollar weakness that determines the bilateral exchange rate.
Let's take a quick phone call from Greg in Madison, who's been patiently waiting. Greg, good morning. Thanks for holding. Greg, are you still with us?
Hello, John. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, go ahead.
John. Sorry, I had you on mute. Absolutely fascinating show, and it's taken quite a few twists and turns. But I just want to go back to the idea that the Spanish construction industry collapsed. And we in Madison saw a huge construction boom during the housing bubble. And it seemed to me that individual, you know, actors were entering the market in order to pursue some sort of perceived profit opportunity, while an outside observer could easily see this thing was not sustainable. You know, people were making money building homes, so more people said, I'll make money building homes too, but they weren't taking into account what the ultimate demand for homes was. And then the construction industry collapsed, and maybe that's one of the reasons Greece is in so much trouble right now. So my question is, and it's quixotic, because I don't see how you can restrict people entering a market, and I don't see how you can issue controls to predict that, you know, the market is saturated. But isn't this kind of thing obvious to the outside observer? That can't go on forever. There's got to be a collapse, and then it leads to all these problems. Is there anything we can do about it?
No, I mean, first of all, in the case of Spain, no, I mean, there's no doubt that this was a massive housing and construction bubble. And just to give you give everybody an indication of how big it was, it's really important to understand that the relative share of the construction sector, the private residential construction sector, at the peak of the Spanish housing bubble was twice as big. Twice as big a share of the total Spanish economy as the housing or the real estate industry was when it peaked here in the United States in 2006-2007. So the magnitude of the bubble is just a lot bigger. With respect to, and there were certainly many warning signs here, people saying, look, it is insane that you in Spain keep buying, keep building, you know, three or four times as many houses as your population growth will sustain in the long run. But back then you will hear, you know, what in retrospect, of course, is poor excuses like, well, we have immigration, we're going to build second homes for people from all over Europe. They're going to have their holiday homes here in Spain. And there are many reasons for why back then it was believed to be sustainable. So there is an element of, you know, what Keynes used to call the animal spirit, this sort of or irrational exuberance, in the words of Alan Greenspan, about this, that in a bubble, you fundamentally believe things are sustainable, which in retrospect turns out to be anything but. And what you can do about it, well, it's very, you know, you can't outlaw, there's no rule against stupidity, if you like. But what you can do, and what I think in retrospect the Spanish authorities failed to do, is the key thing here is really to restrict credit growth in the banking system so that you basically do not allow banks to go on an enormous lending spree that just goes on year after year. And normally you would do that with interest rates. But the problem, of course, is that Spain, as being a member of the euro area, doesn't have its own interest rates, doesn't have its own central bank. So therefore, interest rates is not really the appropriate tool, which means you're going to have to use much more sort of prudential-type regulation, meaning that it is the specific Spanish banking regulators that have to go in and basically say, you know what, we don't think that's a good idea that you keep having lending growth of 10, 15, 20% a year. But this is tough. I mean, imagine what would have happened if, let's say, the Federal Reserve or the FDIC in 2005 had told various mortgage originators here in the United States, you know what, we don't think you should keep lending out all this money to all these subprime borrowers. You know, you'd have a you'd have an enormous political backlash against that because it was you know, during the it was still during the boom. So this is very tough to do. You know, taking away the punch bowl, as a former head of the Federal Reserve said many years ago, is politically a very tough thing to do in any economy. And unfortunately, in the case of Spain and other countries in Europe, they're right now suffering the consequences of that.
We'll take a break, and then we'll come back and talk some more about some of these issues. I have some more questions. Perhaps some of our callers do, too. Here's the number, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. We'll be back to talk more about what's going on in the Eurozone, and we're going to talk about Iceland because that's, I think, a really cool story, and that's kind of how we got onto this in the first place. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up next hour, Judith Sears-Poisson is in for Larry Miller, and she'll find out how the early spring has affected our birds. That's coming up after the news at 11 o'clock. This hour we're talking about what's going on financially and economically in the Eurozone and in Iceland, where they've kind of turned things around in a rather unique way. Jacob Kierkegaard is my guest. He's a research fellow at the Peterson Institute and a senior associate at the Rhodium Group, a New York-based research firm. Well, before we do talk about Iceland, one more thing about what's going on in the Eurozone. Our previous caller, I think he was alluding to, and you talked about, we've got this boom and bust cycle going on. And we saw, I mean, we've seen this kind of thing happen worldwide in the past. It happened, it's happened in pretty much every century since we have developed what could be called the modern banking system. But obviously there was the Great Depression. That was a worldwide economic downturn. After that, however, there were a lot more restrictions placed on banking and speculation, which was seen as kind of at the heart of all of this, over-speculation, making us more vulnerable to the boom and bust cycle. Is there a need for some sort of worldwide banking standards so that we can get past this boom and bust cycle? Or is our long-term economic health kind of dependent on being able to do whatever the heck we want, even if it's take the train over the edge of the cliff?
No, I mean, I very strongly, or I believe, or I belong to the group that strongly believes that tighter regulation of the bank, the global banking system and the global financial system more broadly is absolutely required here, because I think one of the more disturbing elements of the entire aftermath of the crisis, which, as you said, in my opinion, is directly linked, particularly in the United States. In Europe, the origins of the crisis are more deep-rooted, but certainly in the United States has to do with the lack of regulation of the financial system and the associated incentive problems that creates, because the large in financial institutions know that many of them are too big to fail, which means that it's the old story of, you know, heads I win, tails you, the taxpayers lose. And as long as that continues, unfortunately, we have a situation where we condemn ourselves, if you like, to this to repeat itself, because it is fundamentally in the interest of members of the large part of the financial system to take these kinds of big risks or take the train over the cliff, if you like, because they know that in the end, taxpayers will have to bail them out in the same way as the Treasury and the Federal Reserve had to do back in 2008 and early 2009.
Well, I think this is a great time then to transition into a quick discussion as we come to the last 10 minutes or so of the program of what happened in Iceland, because there the people had some teeth and they stepped up and they said, you know what, this is wrong, and Parliament, Prime Minister, you're all out. Bad bankers, we're putting you on trial, and oh, by the way, we're going to just basically say we're not going to pay all these loans, and we're going to do things differently. I know that's a vast oversimplification of what happened, but I want to get into the discussion of that. So what was, you know, I mean, how did Iceland get away with doing things in such a radical way? They basically had a revolution there.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a couple of things that one must always keep in mind when we talk about Iceland. That, you know, Iceland is an independent country. It's a big country if you look at it on the map. But it is also only 200 and about, you know, somewhere between 200 and 250,000 people. So it's not much bigger than a mid-sized U.S. City. And when that's the case, you know, you do have some more freedom to things you can do than if you are a very large economy like the United States. And then the other thing that people have to remember about Iceland is that of all the financial bubbles in the world that burst in 2008, probably Iceland was the most extreme. Several people have characterized Iceland pre-crisis as a country that was run like a hedge fund, which I basically largely subscribe to, because Iceland was a country that pre-crisis, its banks had more than 600% of GDP in foreign loans, in foreign currency loans. Now, that would be the equivalent then of here in the United States if U.S. banks had somewhere between $90 and $100 trillion in foreign loans. So the scale of the speculative bubble in Iceland was just absolutely unprecedented. And therefore, you know, I don't think we should be surprised that the public reaction to this, which really was the result of the excessive speculation of the three big Icelandic banks and their political masters in the Icelandic government. So this was a very small number of very high-profile people that basically ran the country into the ditch. And Iceland, being a country which, of course, has historically been very devoted to open government, accountability, transparency, and democracy, well, they basically bit the bullet. They let their banks go bust, and they, as you said, put their prime minister on trial for gross negligence, as well as all of the heads of all of these banks. So you really do have an unprecedented degree of accountability being imposed on Icelandic society post-crisis. But as I said, I think that really must kept in mind just how extreme the bubble was before the crisis hit.
Well, there were also people, foreign investors were willing to lend Iceland money. I mean, it wasn't just their banks lending money out. Other banks in other countries looked at Iceland and said, sure, we'll make a bet on that. And they had a lot of money in there, too. How did this contribute to the crisis?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's no doubt that many of the foreign lenders to Iceland, you know, they share a significant share of the blame here, no doubt about it. Although I will say, and subsequently, that's one of the reasons why the Icelandics said, look, we're just going to let our banks collapse, and thereby imposing losses on these foreign borrowers, foreign lenders. But there was one element of this entire crisis, which I think is important also to keep in mind, which is this program called Ice Save. And which was basically a program that some of the Icelandic banks operated in the UK and the Netherlands. They opened retail banks and they took a lot of deposits from customers in the UK as well as the Netherlands in the last years or so before the bust. And they basically, the way they did this was essentially a Ponzi scheme, because these Icelandic banks opened up branches in the UK and the Netherlands, and they opened and they offered much higher deposit rates than local banks in order to attract new customers. And this is important because remember that these markets are much bigger. So in fact, ICE Save had more customers in the UK than there are people in Iceland. But of course, what happened was that as the banks went bankrupt, the problem is that the Icelandic deposit insurance scheme is a much lower threshold than the similar deposit insurance scheme for the UK and Netherlands. So when the Icelandic banks collapsed, the UK government and the Dutch government basically went in and they froze all the deposits and they froze all the assets of these Icelandic banks in the countries, and they blocked international financial assistance to Iceland, which, as I said, I don't blame the UK or Dutch government for that because, as I said, this was fundamentally a Ponzi scheme operated by the Icelandic banks against retail depositors in these countries. So it is not only a matter of, you know, scrupulous foreign lenders to Icelandic banks. These banks went actively out and tried, in my opinion, to defraud retail depositors in other European countries to keep their scheme going.
So is there anything we can learn from the Icelandic situation that could be applied in Europe or even in the United States?
Well, I certainly believe that more than anything, Iceland serves as a warning sign, basically, as an indication of how important proper banking regulation is for an economy. Because Iceland, and in many ways, it shares many of the same similarities with Ireland. Iceland was an economy that had everything going for it. It had low unemployment. It has well education, you know, good education. It is clean. You know, there's not much corruption, if any. So it's basically a very well-functioning economy with very few social problems. The only thing they messed up was their banking sector. And as a result, the country basically went over the cliff. So it really does signal that you can get everything else right. If you get your banking system wrong, it doesn't matter. You're going to have a devastating economic crisis.
So going forward, and we only have about a minute left, going forward, what would you say, if you could name the top two or three things that need to happen in the Eurozone in order to get them out of this mess they're in with Greece and some of these other countries, what do you think is the most important one or two things that they can do?
Sure. In the short run, meaning in the next 6 months or so, the European Union or the euro area needs to institute a banking union, which means they need to have an integrated European or euro area version of the FDIC. So they have to have an integrated deposit insurance scheme, and they have to have an integrated resolution and banking regulation system put in place in the euro area. The second thing that the euro area, in my opinion, very clearly needs, it needs articulation of the long-term vision for Europe, which means that it needs to basically, European leaders need to get together and they need to basically come up with a blueprint for the long-term future of the euro area, which include things like a euro bond, or which is the European version of a treasury bond, which is something that it's very politically difficult to implement because of opposition from Germany, and therefore it can only happen in the long run.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it there because we have run out of time. It's one of the bad things about radio. We are subject to the clock. Thank you very much, Jacob Kierkegaard, research fellow at the Peterson Institute and senior associate at the Rhodium Group. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing the program and Marika Suval for on-air production. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, it's the Ideas Network.